started yesterday. We spoke yesterday about the idea that evil is the absence of good, and I told you that that's no great advantage, because absence of good can be deadly. So it's really more a matter of how God looks at good and evil, rather than a matter of what it is to us. To us, the absence of good can be absolutely devastating. It's not meant as comfort to say that evil is only the absence of good. Babies die if they don't get physically expressed love. Then he says that God is giving good continuously. If we receive less, it's because we cut it out. We filter it out. We block it. In other words, God set up a system whereby he's giving continuously, and he gave us the power to receive in varying degrees. Ibn Ezra gives the analogy of a person who puts blue panes of glass in his windows and then complains that God gives monochromatic light. You know, he only gives one color light. Yeah, you can complain, right? But it's not God's fault. In the sunlight, there's a full spectrum of hues, of colors. And he's simply filtering out all the others. This is probably part of the reason why in the Shemona Esrei, in the prayer, when at the end of each blessing you express the fact that God is the one from whom what you're asking for comes, they're all in the present tense. Even though we don't see equally that all these good things are happening, that's true, because although God is doing them present tense continuously, we're putting ourselves in a position where we can't receive them. The brutal, dramatic image that comes to my mind is after the Holocaust, when the camps were liberated, there were people there who were starving. I mean, there were skeletons. And the good-hearted soldiers, especially those from the Soviet Union, because they were too ignorant, but even in some cases American soldiers, opened up their food stores and just gave them whatever they wanted. And many of them died because their stomachs burst. They just couldn't take it. So here, they're in desperate need of nutrition, and the nutrition is there, but they can't take it. They can't take it. They should have been given in soup until their digestive systems recovered. So the image here is that God is giving, and we put ourselves in a position where we can't receive, and that's why there's variable effects on different people. Okay, chapter 5 is a discussion of an overview of all the parts of creation. I'm going to do all of the chapter, but at least the overview of the structure is quite interesting. There are two realms. There's the realm of the spiritual and the realm of the physical. Physical things are those that can be perceived. That's the way he describes it. All the things can be perceived. Which includes the heavens, stars, that's all physical. I suppose today we would say that it can be perceived with instrumentation. We'd have to add instrumentation. We want molecules and atoms to be physical. We want infrared radiation to be physical, so forth and so on. The spiritual, he identifies negatively as all the things that cannot be perceived. That doesn't tell you much about what they are, but that's how the realms are divided. Now, within each realm, there are many, many different entities that belong to that realm. The physical, obviously, the earth and the fullness thereof, and the skies and the rest. The spiritual includes the angels and what he calls the heavenly forces, transcendental forces. The body, the human body, is a physical thing, belongs to the physical realm. human soul is a spiritual thing, as well as the spiritual realm. Then there are two particular items that need special discussion. One is man. Man is a duality. Man has two elements, one from each realm. As we said, the body is from the physical realm and the soul is from the spiritual realm. It's two elements, each of which has its own home, forced into an association with one another, which, as you may imagine, is a very unnatural association. Given the nature of the physical and the nature of the spiritual, it's an unnatural association, but one that is necessary, as we have said in the past, for free will. And man, he says here, is the only element, only creature with that duality, which would mean that it's the only creature with free will. I spoke to you briefly about the possibility that maybe angels have a little free will and maybe there are partial exceptions, but in terms of the basic structure, man is the only dual element, and since he's the only dual element, he's the only one that's going to possess free will. Then he mentions shading. It's hard to translate shading. Some say it means demons, but that's not quite right. There are very interesting discussions in the Talmud about someone who is the king of this group and his ideas, observations, and his activities, and he's painted as quite sympathetic and helpful to people who need help, and attacking people who need to be attacked, and quite sensitive. It's not at all what the English word demons calls to mind. And these creatures, says Ramchal, have some physical features and some spiritual features. That's not the same as man. Man is composed of one fully spiritual thing, that's 100% spiritual, the soul, and one physical thing that's 100% physical. And because these two things are, that they come from opposite realms, putting together is problematic. A shade is something which has some physical features and some spiritual features. Features. It's one thing, it's not a double. But if you look at its features, it shares some with this side and some with that side. So it is a consistent, integrated entity, just that it doesn't fit squarely into either realm. I'll give you an analogy to the difference here. If you consider a person driving a car, so the person is alive and the car isn't. And this is a combination of a live thing and a non-live thing. Now let's take a virus. There is some discussion among biologists and philosophers whether a virus should be classified as alive or not. Because, on the one hand, a virus on its own can't do anything. A virus planted in the richest broth of nutritive molecules can't do anything. It just sits there, does nothing. Can it reproduce? Not under those conditions. Can't make more viruses. It just sits there, does nothing. Ah, but let the virus invade a cell, then it is able to take over the cell's machinery for manufacturing molecules, and it can force the cell's machinery to manufacture more copies of itself. So, is that reproduction? Well, not as you usually understand it, but on the other hand, given the machinery, it can hijack the machinery to make more copies of itself. So, is it alive or isn't it alive? It's sort of borderline, you know. It's sort of semi-alive. That's why there's a discussion about it. The man in the car, there's no discussion at all. He's alive and the car is dead, or not alive. That's just a combination. So human being is like the man in the car, and the shade is like the virus. The only one that's, I would put it, problematic to understand how it exists, how it can function, is man. Because it consists of these two items, these two different elements, the realms.
Questions?
Yeah.
You said that the spiritual cannot be perceived.
Yeah.
How would that fit with such things as prophecy? I mean, aren't they experiencing something spiritual?
Well, do you see prophecy with your physical eyes?
Oh, I mean, perceived with your eye, it has to do with your physical eyes.
Okay, good. We're making progress. That's a good observation. Number one, the experience of prophecy is not something which is perception. And even in English, the word perception is not used for that. Perception is used for interacting with your environment. When you're dreaming, you're not perceiving. Not in English. So number one, the question will be, where does the experience come from? Number two, the way it's usually understood, if we'll get to the chapter on prophecy in the third part, we'll see it there, that the experience of prophecy, the experience, is the result of that higher element acting on the imagination of the person, and the imagination of the person is tied to his physical being, and producing images. So when he has in his prophetic vision a vision of an ox, that's not like walking out into the barnyard and seeing oxen. Rather, he has an inner experience of an ox, and that ox that he experiences is a symbol for some abstract thing which is spiritual. So the experience is one which takes place in the imagination, is fed by that higher level, it's not through the eyes. And secondly, it's not an experience of an ox, it's an image of an ox, which is a symbol for something else, which isn't an ox. That's roughly what I would say. Now, he now...
One second, so what... What about all these prophets that actually God, when God spoke to them? So it wasn't something that... What you're saying, it seems like what you're saying is that when you see an ox, that's not actually the... It's prophecy, but it's not actually prophecy, because it's not really a spiritual thing coming with a physical thing, because you can't really do that. Unless you want to
say... I want to say what I said before, again, but I'm not going to... There's a whole chapter on prophecy. I said, when we get there, we'll go into more detail. But it's a little bit like this. You know, using holograms, they can create pictures that have very peculiar, give you very peculiar visual experiences. Which I think it's JFK, where you come in and you're walking, and as you walk, the picture changes. You have a thing, and then you go another few steps, you see what's inside it, and then it changes to something else, right? Now, you know enough to know that the thing isn't really changing, though your vision of it is changing, because it's created in such a way that as you move, you see what looks like a change, even though the thing isn't changing. So you distinguish in your mind the thing that I'm relating to and how it looks. And you say, well, it looks like it's changing, but I know it's not changing. It's just that kind of thing which is designed to look like it's changing, even though it really isn't changing. Okay? So now, when we talk about the vision of the ox, that's what's happening inside me. It doesn't tell you what the thing outside that's causing it is. The thing outside causing you one thing, and what it causes in me can be something else. Just like that panel that you see when you walk down the entranceway to JFK, it isn't changing, but what you perceive is what you experience is changing. So you say, well, it's not changing, but I am, right? So here also, in my mind is an ox, but there's no ox out there. There's something else out there, which, by interacting with me, is causing me to have an inner vision of an ox. Okay? That's, now, prophecy could be a relationship with that kind of thing, which results in this kind of vision. That could be the definition of prophecy. Okay? Now, he describes here, and a few paragraphs later, that there is a hierarchy of levels and how God relates to it. This is really very important, and we'll go back to what we said at the beginning. Picture a chain. God's at the top of the chain. Below that are what he called the transcendental forces. Kophos.
Beings.
No, transcendental forces. Oh. Being, if being just means existence, okay, but you have in mind some kind of personality. No. Transcendental forces. Below that are angels. And then below that is our world. So, the first picture is God sits at the top, and from him emanate all sorts of directions, energies, and they are carried by the transcendental forces down through the angels to our world. That puts God at the top of a chain, and the influence comes down the chain. Then he says, but God is present at every level of the chain and is overseeing and directing all the activities at every level on the chain, from top to bottom. At this point, if you're following, you ought to ask, what then is the use of the chain? If he's present at every level, and he's directing what happens at every level, who needs the chain? The use of a chain is that if I hold the chain here, and I move it, the motion will be felt over there, and I don't have to go over there. See, I can do it from a long distance. But if I'm holding the chain, and I'm waving the chain, and then I walk by, and I take each link of the chain, and give it its own little wave, so then what do I need the chain for? You know, just walk to the end and do it. Part of the reason, yeah.
Well, when you, if you have a company, and you're the head of a company, and you have a supervisor for each level, why can't you just get rid of all the people and use the supervisors to do the things?
Why? But you see, and when you have the head of the company, you are not present physically, personally, at every level of the activity. You sit in your office, and you give directives to the managers, and they give to the sub-managers, and the sub-managers give to the plant manager, the floor manager, the floor manager gives to the workers. And you don't go down to the manager, the sub-manager, the floor, and you don't go to each worker and tell them what to do. That's why you have these intermediaries. But imagine now, I tell you, the plant manager gives out instructions, the instructions go all the way down the chain, and then he walks down the chain and tells each one what to do. Who's going to do that? Why not skip the intermediary, just go to the bottom and do it? One reason, which he stresses at great length in other writings of his, is this. In his own being, God is infinite, infinite, utterly beyond, utterly transcending our world, utterly transcending anything we can understand. Let's suppose that everything that happened came directly from his own infinity. And all of his own infinity was taken into account in producing each thing that happened. Would we have a clue what was going on? I don't think we would have a clue. Because each thing will have infinite depth of reason behind it. It would be impossible for us to appreciate it. So what God did is that he decided not to act with his whole infinity, to hold it back and use only a tiny, tiny slice of his infinity, and not an infinite slice. I'm aware the slice of infinity can be infinite. I mean a finite slice of infinity, so that when he interacts with us, we can understand. I'll give you a little example of what I mean. Just imagine a chess master playing a game of chess with a 9-year-old. So if a chess master will use the whole of his expertise in choosing each move, the 9-year-old will be in mystery until the final move where it's checkmate. He won't even see it coming. What will the 9-year-old learn from that? Nothing, except that the chess master is a much better player than he is. And he can't figure out what's going on. So what will the chess master do? First of all, he'll make very simple moves. He'll make moves which are related to the 9-year-old in a pretty obvious way. If the 9-year-old doesn't see it, listen, you know, why I put my move on knight there? I'm moving on knight there because you put your king there. I'm cutting off a defense for you. See, that's why. He'll play a much simplified game, and he will explain to the 9-year-old what rules he's using so the 9-year-old can play. Now, something like that, God says, part of playing this game for the human being, is that the human being should understand. The human being is not supposed to play blind. But he is supposed to understand. Now, how is God going to create a universe with finite creatures in it and interact with them in a way that the creature can understand? Only if he holds back his infinity and operates according to rules, and these rules could be available to us for us to be able to study and appreciate. So we'll know what's happening when we interact with God. So, the transcendental forces and the angels, each with its own label, and each with its own role, each with its own capacity, is a structure which he uses and which he reveals to us. It's the structure of his activity. It's how he does it. But it's he doing it. It's he doing it from top to bottom. There isn't anybody else there. There aren't any partners. There aren't even any delegated subordinates who sort of carry things on their own when the boss has to go elsewhere on vacation. No, he's present at every level, and he's operating every level. And the levels are there only that he's committed. He's committed to operating in such a way that we can understand it, and we can relate to it, and we can live with it. One little example that he does mention in a chapter on divine justice in the second part is this. Let's imagine a person commits a crime. Now we have a structure. We have a day of judgment on Rosh Hashanah, and a day of judgment on Yom Kippur, and there are things you can do to try to mitigate it. Imagine that God was running the world from his infinity. Well, the instant the crime is committed, God knows about it. And he's in total control of everything that's going on. So the person should get zapped immediately. As it is, the crime is committed in January. You know, he has months and months before it's really going to come up for final judgment. And there are things he can do about it. And then the judgment takes a certain form. It's only according to certain rules. That's so that we can interact with it with understanding. And use our understanding as part of our means of relating to it. Otherwise, we'd be like the 9-year-old playing chess with the chess master, and we'd be intellectually out of the picture. Yeah.
I just want to understand on the levels. You said God is there watching, and
directing,
right? So is God infinitely there directing, or is he on each level, or is him himself? Did he make himself?
Very good. Very good. So I'll tell you the vocabulary that he uses in one of his works. I have fought with other people about this, but I believe that my way of putting this right. He says, I think in his words he addresses your question exactly. He says, no matter how much of you use in your action, you, all of you, are the agent behind the action. Who's playing the game with the 9-year-old? The chess master. That's his play. He's just chosen not to use all of his intelligence and strategy in playing the game. So you have to distinguish between the quality of the action, on the one hand, and identifying who the agent is, on the other hand. The agent is the whole, in this case, the whole chess master, all of him. He's just not using, in this action, all of his ability. And the difference will be this, that in the world, I've mentioned this to you on another occasion, in the world, our goal is to achieve attachment to God. If the goal is to achieve attachment to God, he has to be available. If I say that part of him is missing, then I can't attach to him. You see? That's why it's crucial that he's present at every level, and he's wholly present. He's wholly present at every level. He just isn't wholly functioning at every level. So he's available, but not acting out of all of what he is. So that's it. And here again is something which I've only found in Ramchal. Ramchal is the only one that I know who even asks questions like this. What's the difference between the quality of the action, the quality of the agent? So I keep saying he's a philosopher. Yeah.
So like an angel is really just God and like functioning on a lot of levels.
I don't think that's wholly accurate, but from what I've said so far, your words agree with the words I've said so far. But I don't know, I don't think it's wholly accurate. I don't know if I can really say. I'm just pointing out a footnote that, you know, you have to look for further clarification, either from me or from somebody else. Now, yeah.
But then it doesn't seem really like a chain. It's just you have the way he's interacting with each different thing.
Yeah, you could do it that way, but then the chain here is just the structure of the understanding.
So you interact with everything.
There are main principles, and there are subsidiary principles, and the subsidiary principles are related to the main principles in various ways. That's part of the understanding that you get. That it isn't, you know, it's sort of like mathematics. We have axioms and theorems. You could teach each theorem separately. I just have hundreds and hundreds of facts about mathematics that are true, but then you wouldn't understand why they're true. You understand what makes them true. Right? When you see the deduction from the axioms, you get more than just learning the facts of mathematics. Here, if you have for each thing the particular reason that was behind each thing, you wouldn't have the same understanding as you will when you understand that all these reasons are related to one common purpose, and this one common purpose is a means to that kind of that purpose, and those two purposes together function. You have a hierarchy of principles that gives you a fuller understanding of how the principles work. Yeah.
Why not just have God in his infinity, and then one more level, which is what we're able to understand.
That's what he just asked. My answer is that if you had only one more level, your amount of understanding would be very limited. You know, it's sort of like this. There are a lot of substances in the world. Thousands and thousands of different substances. Now just imagine a book which for each substance tells you what its properties are. Now you can build and you can melt them and you can make Rolex watches, and because you know every substance and what it does. Now compare that with atomic theory, where there are about 90 natural elements, and everything that exists is a combination of those elements. And the combinations are explained, if that's not too fanciful a word, explained by science down to the quantum level, so you understand why the atoms do what they do, so your depth of understanding is much, much greater. So it's something like that.
So this means then that everything in our world is somehow related to the angels, which is then related to the transcendental forces, which is then related to God.
That's
so we haven't explained that yet.
What
how they're related. We've only explained how God interacts with each level.
Well, what more of a relationship do you need than how he interacts?
For example, let's say you didn't have the angels. God could still interact with the transcendental forces on one level and then interact with us on another level. And it's not like if you're missing...
But then I would not be sure, because then it would be like, you know, having the axioms and being told that from the axioms this follows without seeing how it follows. So I tell you that you know what numbers are, and you know that some numbers are prime numbers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it just so happens there's an infinity of prime numbers. They never run out. You know what the numbers are. You know what the basic properties are. And I'm telling you, there's an infinity of prime numbers. You know much less than you would if I gave you the proof of it. You would understand why, if you have these basic properties, there have to be infinity. Not just an accident, it has to be. You have an explanation of why there is infinity. Then you would understand better. If the name of the project is understanding, you don't want to skip levels. If you skip levels, you sacrifice understanding. Now, our world is run through those levels. So you picture God at the top of the chain, and as we said, present at every level of the chain. Everything that happens in our world, almost, there'll be an exception in a minute, almost everything that happens in our world is a result of God at the top of the chain initiating some interaction, and then that interaction tracing its way down to the chain, into our world, and having certain effects. Almost everything works that way. Except for what? Quiz time. If you don't know, I'm going to cancel the class. What doesn't work that way? Huh? Free will, of course. Free will doesn't work that way. If it worked that way, it wouldn't be free. Can't be just God initiating something at the top, trickling down to the bottom, and bang, it happens. No, free will is exempt from that. Yes, we need the trickle to live, to exist. We need the trickle down in order to have the capacity of free will. But the choice itself can't be trickled down. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a choice. Good. So, first of all, the free choice is an exception to the trickle-down picture. But then he says it's more than that. Because everything is connected. Everything's connected. Everything in this world is connected to the angelic level, and that's connected to the transcendental forces level, and that's connected to God himself. So that if you move anything in the chain, the rest of the chain is going to be affected. My picture here is a rope ladder. Now, if you haven't seen old World War II movies, you don't know what a rope ladder is. But, a rope mesh. When a ship that carries thousands of soldiers has to deliver the soldiers to shore, the ship can't come in close to shore because it's too heavy. So it sits some ways up, and you have boats that are on the surface. And down the side of the boat comes this rope mesh. It's vertical and horizontal ropes, which create a kind of mesh of squares, and the guys clamber down the ropes down to the boats. That's how it's done. Ah, history. Now, imagine one of those things hanging in the air. So, you know, like 50 feet wide and 100 feet tall, all made of rope in these squares. Now, imagine you stand towards the center at the bottom, take hold the end of this rope mesh, and you give a yank. What's going to happen? Well, the motion is going to push itself up and out because it's all connected. It's all connected and it's all loose. So when you get a yank, it's going to go rippling up. Someone stands at the top, gives a yank, it's going to go rippling down. Someone grabs it in the middle and gives a yank. The ripples could go both ways. Or maybe if he gives a limited kind of yank, it'll only go down. At any rate, everything's connected to everything else. So, if the human being performs an action that's not a result of the trickle-down, a free choice, a freely chosen action, that's going to affect the mesh. He's yanking the rope from the bottom. And that's going to have a ripple effect up. It may not ripple all the way to the top, it may ripple some distance up. Okay, you with me so far? Quiz number two. And then what will happen?
Then it's going to affect up and it's going to come right down.
Right, on the target today. The ripple up is going to ripple down because everything is connected. So a yank here can cause ripples to go up or ripples to come down someplace else. Everything can be affected. Man, by his free choice, can affect other things, and if the free choice is powerful enough and directed at a central enough portion of the mesh, it could affect everything. You begin to get a picture, at least on this level, how you see man's power. Okay, now for a really tough question. Can you put this together with what we said yesterday? What did we talk about yesterday as relevant to this?
So many things. We cover up.
We talked about the real meaning of mitzvahs. That's what's hidden.
Yeah, more specifically, talking about top and middle and the more powerful and the less powerful. And talking about a particular mitzvah and talking about its particular effect.
We talked about learning Torah and how it affects all of creation. Well,
yesterday we talked about the learning of Torah, and we said there is the highest energy, and that energy affects the whole of creation. And by learning Torah, you interact with that energy, and thereby can have effect on the whole of creation. Now, with this metaphor of the rope mesh, you begin to understand, because the mitzvah, a certain type of mitzvah, might be able to ripple all the way to the top. And if it ripples all the way to the top, then it could have subsidiary ripples coming all the way down throughout the entire mesh. One second.
Sorry.
Throughout the entire mesh. That's okay. I just want to finish it there. You're going to have it coming all the way down throughout the entire mesh. So you begin to see how this sort of thing is possible. Now I have to add one more thing that he says. Another capacity that man has. Man is at the bottom of the mesh. And every action that he performs has an effect on the bottom. Someplace or some places, and because it has an effect on the bottom, the ripples communicate through the mesh. But man has the ability to reach up and touch directly higher levels in the mesh. Not through the bottom, but to reach up and touch them directly and give them a shake. And if you reach up to a higher point and give the mesh a shake, from there, it'll have a much more powerful effect coming down because it's not diluted by the upward mesh. So man has really a double ability. He has the ability through free will to create his own effect on the mesh, which is not caused wholly by the trickle-down. And he can reach up and create an effect other than at the bottom. And those, so in the study of Torah, it might be that he can reach directly to the top and shake the mesh from the top, rather than having to shake it from the bottom, have the upwards dilute it until it finally ripples down to the bottom in a much weaker fashion. Your question.
I was actually thinking as I look up every mitzvah that we actually do, or every avera we actually do, we actually affect
the energy that has been poured down into the world. Even a negative capacity or positive.
That's quite true. Every action. That's why I said every free choice. I didn't say every free choice. You're quite right. I mean, every free choice is going to affect the mesh one way or another. And this is the power that the human being has. This is kind of physical parallel to give you an image of how it works. You with me so far? Yeah.
There's one thing I don't understand. From the way we explain free will, it sounds like free will wasn't on the mesh.
Free will isn't on the mesh. It has an effect on the mesh.
How can something affect the mesh and not be on the mesh?
I'm standing at the bottom. I'm not on the mesh. I'm standing at the bottom, and I grab hold of it, and I give it a shake.
Right, but the only way to affect it is if you're, in a sense, touching it and affected by anything that would touch it from the top.
Let's see. Is my brain affecting the mesh when I grab it with my hand and give it a shake?
No. Think again. But then if someone shakes it from the top, it's going to move your whole body.
It depends upon the strength of the ripple that reaches me. And if I'm standing in the extreme right-hand side, he's shaking from the extreme left-hand side, the ripple might not reach me at all. It might be so small that it's almost imperceptible. But surely, if my hand takes the thing, gives it a shake, my brain is affecting the mesh. Otherwise, I wouldn't have shaked it with my hand.
But then it sounds, you're saying, like, the intensity of the thing is what will affect you. But if the free will is completely off of it,
I know what completely means here. If this free will is not hanging on the mesh, but the free will affects the motions of my body, and my body is in this world, and
so you're saying that the transcendental forces can never shake it hard enough that it'll end up touching your free will.
No, I don't say they can't. I say they don't. This is crucial. This is a crucial. Now you aren't going to make this mistake again. But since it came up, let me explain carefully because this comes up all the time. There's a great difference between saying God has chosen not to use certain aspects of his power, which is true, it's a fundamental idea, versus saying he doesn't have all power. Indeed, they're contradictory. To say he chose not to use it implies he has it. And that's why he had to choose not to use it. Now, when other things operate in a way that's sort of independent of God, independent of God, that doesn't mean he doesn't have power. It means he has chosen not to use it. So the free will, and the proof of it is that if God wants to take away free will, he can. And indeed, in some cases, he has. So it isn't as if free will is beyond his power. He has chosen not to interfere with it, because for him, free will is a crucial element in the creation fulfilling its purpose. Okay, now, right, you said this. Now, he makes a distinction here, which I'll read to you, and this here is again a case where he's saying something in certain terms, and the real understanding of it has to be provided from other terms as well. And for those who are following text on page 83, although I think I'll do my own translation here. We said that God is present at every level, and he's directing every level. But there's a difference between good and evil that come out of the levels. For good, God is described as the cause, the actual cause, for its general characteristics and its details. But for evil, we don't describe him as the actual cause. Because God does not identify his name with evil. Rather, it is the absence of his light and the hiddenness of his face, which are considered to be the root of evil. Because that is the true cause of it. Rather, just because of the absence of good. And the details of evil in its existence God, who is all-powerful and there's no limit to his power, created a root and source, a root, detailed root and source for evil. Directed, focused on this purpose to generate the details of evil, according to what the higher wisdom decided was necessary for this. And that's why it says he creates light and creates darkness, does peace and creates evil.
Now,
it's very hard from these words to get a picture of what's going on. Is he there or isn't he there? We were told before that he's present at every level, directing everything that happens at every level. Then he says, as far as that's true for good, for evil, he is the source of it in general, but in particular, he created another source which is supposed to, although that other source that he created is focused and directed detail for detail for the exact parts that the evil needs, and so on and so on. In other books, that he wrote, and other books of a different aspect of Jewish literature, they talk about qualities of relationship. Even human relationships, although the terms are not. One quality of relationship is face to face. Then you have face to back and back to back. Face to face, as you know from your experience, when you face another person and interact with them, there's a maximum openness. You express yourself through your face, through your words, through your facial expressions. He's facing you, so he sees you. His sense organs are pointed at you, and he can receive from you what you're trying to send. And that goes back and forth between the two of you. Imagine talking to somebody's back. What happens when you talk to somebody and turns his back on you? What is he saying to you? I don't want to hear you. Okay, the sound waves will travel right around into his ears. But he's turned his back on you. Which means he's not receiving all you have to send. He's cut off a great deal of what you have to send because he doesn't want it. Imagine you came to someone to hear from him. He saw you come in the door, he turns around, faces the wall and talks to you. What would be the message? The message would be, okay, I have to talk to you, but I don't want to look at you. I don't want to have that kind of rich interaction with you. To be a rejection. Turning your back on somebody, whether you're the speaker or the listener, is a terrible rejection. Now imagine two people who communicate back to back. Wow. Both of them are sort of locked in the room. They really don't want to have anything to do with each other. Some necessity forces them to interact. But it's each one is protecting himself from a great deal of the interaction and doesn't want it.
Neither one of them know that, though.
Why?
Because neither of them are looking at each other.
Well, if you have very sensitive ears, you can tell the difference between the... At any rate, if you know how the other person feels, you can if you turn around and take a peek. Right. So now, these qualities, face-to-face, face-to-back, which is two really, face-to-back of speaker to the hearer, or hearer to speaker, and back-to-back, are used to describe how God relates to the world and how God relates to particular events, how he interacts with the world. The classification of interactions. That's the metaphor, what the Ramchal and others call the mashal. What's the nimshal? What is the reality that this is trying to express? The reality is whether the item we're talking about is end or means. That's the basic idea. A face-to interaction indicates that what's being addressed is an end. Something that's important for itself. A goal. A back-to interaction means that what's being addressed is a means. It doesn't deserve full attention, full accommodation, full interaction, because it's only a means. It's not the goal. That's roughly the idea that's going on here. Good is the goal. Evil exists only as a means. This is indicated by how God relates to the creation of good and the creation of evil. The creation of good is attended by a face-to interaction. The creation of evil is attended to by a back-to interaction. What verse, what quote from the Gemara does he bring? God does not identify his name with evil. Why? Because a couple of weeks ago you read...
Back-to-back relationship?
Well, it's from his back anyway. Certainly coming from his back, not from his face. It says, God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. Now, in grammar, it's very interesting. God called the light day, that uses God's name, and says what he did. And the darkness he called, in the Hebrew there's no he, and the darkness called night. Now you have repetition of the verb, called, but not the subject. Why do it that way?
Never, in English you never repeat, you don't repeat the subject.
Oh, that's pretty common.
Well, you certainly you can. And secondly, if so, then don't repeat the verb. God called the light day and darkness night. But no, called is there and God isn't. So that's where the Talmud says he doesn't associate his name with evil. Now, he did it! The Torah says he did it. In context, it's surely he used it. Nobody else there. But his name isn't there. Because his name indicates the ultimate goal for which things are happening. And this is an activity which isn't expressive of the goal. It's only expressive of him. So that's roughly what's going on here. This picture of his doing it or facing it or doing it himself or creating another thing which is doing it, it's all him. It's all him. But how is it him? Why is it him? What of him is being involved in the action? That's roughly the difference that we're having. Okay.
Thank you.